Nutrition. This is the taking in and processing of substance that fuel an animal's energy needs for growth, maintenance, reproduction, and everything else. We've seen that insects are able to exploit an incredible breadth of diets, and that to be able to do this, they've had to evolve special mouth parts and gut structures to be able to process these materials. We've looked at the process of digestion. So now we're going to look at, well, actually, what are the nutritional requirements of insects? And how do insects gain these nutrients in terms of feeding behaviour? So the challenge of nutrition is for an insect or any organism is to match their demand for nutrients with their supply. And as we've already mentioned, this occurs across a variety of scales. Evolutionary, what feeding type of you, what food have you evolved to eat? Is it plant or animal? Is it a liquid or solid or a bit of everything? And we've seen how morphology and physiology changes to be able to do this. Also have to do this on a day-to-day basis. What life history stage are you at? Are you a growing insect or are you a reproductive or non-reproductive? What was the last meal? Did it meet your nutrient requirements or not? So, and on the other side, how does supply affect demand? And we're going to look at both of these today, both demand and supply. What pre-ingestive choices are there out there? As an insect, you have to decide what to eat and how much of it and how often. And then how much can an insect use post-ingestive processing to be able to balance the nutritional requirements? So nutrition, this, as I said, it's all the chemicals required for growth, tissue maintenance, reproduction, and all other life activities. And it's the outcome of ingestion, digestion, absorption, metabolism, and excretion. Most people tend to think of nutrition as just being what's ingested. It's not. It's a far greater suite of things that determine what the final nutritional outcome for an insect or any animal is. Now, obviously, ingestion plays a very main role. That's where they take nutrients in. But also, insects can synthesize many nutrients from that ingested. They can. We'll see later how they can make different proteins from those, from different amino acids from the amino acids they take in. But also, a lot of insects use symbionts to produce compounds that they are unable to either ingest directly or make for themselves, synthesize for themselves. Now, insects, given the diversity of foods they eat, if you grind an insect up, it's remarkably similar in its body composition. And they all pretty much do the same thing. They grow, develop, then get reproductively active, lay eggs. And insects pretty much all need the same things. Obviously, there are exceptions, but for the most insects require a source of nitrogen. And we'll go into this in more detail in a minute. They require an energy source, and this can be carbohydrate, fat, or protein. They require fatty acids and sterols. These are either going to be cholesterol if you're an animal eater or plant sterols for plant eaters. And insects require a range of micronutrients, so things such as vitamins and mineral ions. So, what do they require nitrogen for? They require it to get amino acids, which they make into proteins. Proteins are required for structural purposes, enzymes. Proteins are used in transport and storage of other molecules. They're receptor molecules for endocrine products. And they're very heavily involved, obviously, in cuticular sclerotization, especially the aromatic amino acids. Some amino acids have very specific functions, such as tryptophan for Making the visual pigments. And insects, they need about 20 amino acids, but only 10 are considered essential, as the other 10 can be synthesized. This is our generalized amino acid here. It has an amino group, a carboxylic acid group on one end, and then every other amino acid has this side chain which varies. Now, insects can transform amino acids by a process called transamination. It's a transfer of this amino group from one amino acid to another, as you can see that's occurring here. It can take aspartic acid, add it to a keto glutaric acid, and we came up with oxaloacetic acid, but we've got glutamic acid now. So because of that, this transamination process, insects are able to synthesize at least 10 amino acids from 10 main ones. And you'll need to look at Chapman to see what the specific amino acids are. Carbohydrate. It's generally not considered essential, although it is what most insects derive their energy from. But because fats and amino acids via that transamination process, they can remove the nitrogen, animals can make their own carbohydrates. Excess carbohydrate is stored as fats. Carbohydrates are essential for, as I said, an energy source, but also for the chitin, which makes up the main part of the cuticle. Carbohydrates are just chains of carbon with hydrogen and oxygen hanging off them. They have a very simple formula. And animals can ingest these in two forms: simple carbohydrates, which are mono and disaccharides, for example, the monosaccharides, glucose and fructose, and the disaccharides, sucrose and maltose. And they also come in the more complex form, the polysaccharides, things such as glycogen and starch, and cellulose. Now, most insects don't produce cellulases. They can't directly break down cellulose, and this is where they would use symbionts for this. Lipids. This includes the fatty acids, the phospholipids, and the sterols. These are all important, have various different functions. Many of the fatty acids and phospholipids aren't considered essential dietary constituents because many insects can actually synthesize them themselves. And all these all have different functions. Fatty acids, which come in two forms, either saturated or unsaturated, these are exceptional, as well as the phospholipids, are extremely important for cell membrane function. They're involved in molting and reproduction, and energy storage, especially for insects that undergo long-distance migration, such as many lepidopterans and orthopterans. Sterols are absolutely essential. Animals can take it in as cholesterol. Insects that eat animals take it in as cholesterol, whereas insects that eat plants tend to get plant sterols, which they then convert to cholesterol. These are the precursors of the steroid hormones, such as ecdysone, 20-hydroxyecdysone. They're also exceptionally important in cellular membranes. They're the essential structural components that could provide support and rigidity. and without them, development and morphology is greatly affected in insects. Insects must get ingest sterols, or get them from their symbionts. They're unable to synthesize them themselves. Without sterols, or if sterols differ in any way, it can affect development and morphology of things like the cuticle. It'll affect egg laying and development. Sterols are exceptionally important because these are the precursors for the steroid hormones. This is ecdysone. Ecdysone, as you'll be aware by now, is the molting hormone, but it also plays a role in adult reproduction. Sterols also essential structural components of cellular membranes. So insects must get sterols, because without them, they're just not going to develop. Animals need a variety of micronutrients. We know that without these in synthetic diets, we get development either not occurring or we get funny things happening. Vitamins, and these can be either fat-soluble or water-soluble, are essential for different functions. Vitamin A, without it, many insects fail to produce visual pigments or their eyes don't work properly. Vitamin E seems to play a role in reproduction, while vitamin B, we know, are important because, again, these can't be synthesized, they have to be ingested, but they act as enzyme cofactors. Again, ascorbic acid or vitamin C seems to play a role in ichthyosis, that's the shedding of the cuticle. Nucleic acids are required. Also, inorganic compounds such as sodium, potassium, we know are required for the proton pumps, also calcium, magnesium, chloride and phosphate. But also the metals, iron, zinc, magnesium, these are things that are impregnated into the mandibles. Some insects have iron in their hemoglobin, but we don't really know a lot about the micronutrients. We do know that most of them can't be synthesized, that they have to be either ingested from the food or they're taken up, made by the symbiotes. Now, we've sort of seen that every insect requires sort of these macro and micronutrients, but the key to nutrition is matching demand with supply. Now, evolutionarily, the demand is going to change depending on what you eat, and also from day to day. So this is just an example from the Australian plague locust. We're looking at the final nymphal instar, and we're looking at the ratio of, we vary diets in respect to the ratio of protein and carbohydrate, but also how much protein plus carbohydrate. So there was a whole range of dilutions so that they ingested different amounts of protein plus carbohydrate per day. And then we determined how long it took to them to develop, so complete that stadium, and how much they grew. And then from that we're able to plot this growth rate landscape. And you can see from this that we can identify a ratio of protein and carbohydrate where growth is best. And this is slightly higher than 1:1. So they require slightly more carbohydrate than protein. And obviously we get decreased growth rate when the nutrients are diluted, but also if it's ingesting more carbohydrate than protein or more protein than carbohydrate. So we can find an area in this space where our locust does best, and that's around this area here. And if we look at the amount of protein versus carbohydrate required by insects that eat on different foods, not surprisingly, we can see that insects that are carnivores require a diet that's very high in protein compared to carbohydrate, compared to insects that eat something like plant sap that's almost 100% sugar. These are all determined from artificial diet experiments, that same landscape, you can see that these guys do much better on a high carbohydrate diet. And our sort of omnivores are somewhere probably in between here. So we can look at it like this. If you think, as I said earlier, an insect, regardless of its diet or what it eats or what food it exploits, if you grind it up, it's going to have a remarkably similar protein. So a nitrogen versus carbon-based energy. In the form of insects, carbon-based energy is generally stored as lipid. Now, if you're a carnivore, you're eating a diet very much like yourself. And to get to that place there, if you've ingested this ratio of nutrients, you need to get rid of this much protein and this much carbohydrate or carbon energy. Now, if you're a herbivore, you're eating a diet that's far higher in carbohydrate than the nitrogen. Now, these insects, to get from there to what they retain in their body, need to retain almost all of the protein they ingest, but need to get rid of a lot of the carbohydrate. And an omnivore does something in between. It probably needs to get rid of about, you know, same amount of carbohydrate, or protein, sorry, and carbohydrate to end up at that point there. So evolutionarily, these insects have evolved these pathways and mechanisms, in this case to retain protein and get rid of lots of carbohydrate, in this case to probably retain carbohydrate or lipid. A carnivore is going to be eating another insect, but get rid of a lot of protein. So you can imagine, evolutionarily, if your diet shifts and you're a carnivore, you're used to shedding a lot of protein, your diet shifts to become more carbon energy biased, you've still got these pathways, and it's going to, you're then going to be, well, in this case, a fat little insect, or probably suffer costs in terms of growth, development, and survival. But okay, that was sort of the main macronutrients makes important, but also the balance within the macronutrients is quite essential. And this is just an example looking at the different amino acids. This was Phonolensis schistocerca, I think. It was fed lettuce and they impregnated it with different amino acids. And what they found was, or Liz Bernays found and Reg Chapman found, was that when they added phenylalanine, they got this increase in growth. But it's not quite that simple as just adding one. These also have to be in the right, correct balance. If they're not in the correct balance, insects can often take in a lot of protein, but it actually unable to utilize it. Now, to balance nutrition, as I said, it's the outcome of ingestion, digestion, absorption, and metabolism. We're going to look at excretion. We're going to look at some examples now of how insects balance their nutritional needs. Firstly, we're going to look at the pre-ingestive mechanisms. That is, insects can choose what to eat, how much to eat, and how often to eat it. Because foods, generally, your food source is going to contain the necessary chemicals, but they may not be in the correct balance. So the first thing we've established with research establishes, well, what nutrients do insects need to regulate? We've already seen they require both macro and micronutrients. But what we know from studies on herbivores, mostly this guy here, Locusta migratoria, is that it's the two macronutrients, protein, or a source of nitrogen, and carbohydrate, or our carbon-based energy, are what is important. We've already seen that it's not either per se, but the interaction of the two. Now, you're probably saying, well, what about the micronutrients? And what we know from most of our work is that, and the vitamins and sterols and things like that, which are essential, but most insects, in meeting their needs for protein and carbohydrate, are able to get sufficient micronutrients. We do know of some examples where if insects are lacking salts, for example, in their diets, they will specifically go and source that and take a salt meal. This is called puddling. You might see some moths do that. They'll take a meal of, specifically take a meal of salt. However, in the majority of cases, if an animal can get its requirements for protein and carbohydrate, it's getting its requirements for its inorganic ions and sterols, etc. Now, if an animal could, for example, come across a food that's perfectly balanced with respect to protein and carbohydrate for what its requirements, all it has to do is just continue to eat that and it'll pass along and meet that target. And that's that ratio of protein and carbohydrate where growth and development is optimal. And then all an insect would need to do would be to decide how much to eat and how often. So this we can look at to see if insects can regulate this, and we do this by we took a diet that we know is optimal in its protein and carbohydrate requirements for locusta, which is about 1 to 1, and we diluted it fivefold. Now, if this insect just ate it randomly, so it took the same meal size regardless of diet and ate it at the same rate, they would end up here, in here. So on the low dilution, they would eat very little, whereas on the high dilution, they would eat 5 times more. When we fed these diets to our insect, we found that they all ended up in the same space in nutrient, you ate the same amount of protein and carbohydrate. So to be able to do that, the animal had to change its behaviour, its ingestive behaviour. And they did that. So on the most concentrated diet, where we had 35% protein and 35% carbohydrate, these insects ate the least. And on the most dilute, the 7% protein, 7% carbohydrate, they ate 5 times more. And by altering ingestive behaviour, they were able to compensate for the dilution effect of the diets. And we know they do this by taking, on the more dilute diets, they take bigger meals, but they also take them far more frequently. Now, most insects, to get the ratio of protein and carbohydrate to optimize growth, need to select that from different plants or different food sources, sources that vary in their ratio of protein and carbohydrate. So in this case, we have a diet that's higher in protein and carbohydrate, and another second diet where there's more carbohydrate. Now, to be able to get to this optimal ratio of protein and carbohydrates, an insect would need to eat different amounts of these two foods. Now, are insects able to do this, or do they just eat randomly in nature? Do they just eat what they come across? And we can test this to see if there is active regulation in response to dietary manipulation. And again, this has been done with locusts, and this is the groundbreaking work of Steve Simpson and David Romanheimer. And what they did was they tested to see if insects would always try to get the optimal amount of protein and carbohydrate. And they had two diets that varied in the ratio of protein to carbohydrate, and at two different dilutions. So we have this one here, we've got protein and carbohydrate, so that if the animal ate randomly, it would end here. They then diluted one of them, so that if they still took equal meal sizes from each diet, it would end here. Dilute the other one, it would end up here. And dilute both, it would eat here. So if an insect came across these two diet pairings, in these four combinations, they would end up here, here, and here, if they just ate randomly. But if they were to show active regulation and vary the amounts of food they ate, and we already know that they can eat more when a diet's diluted, they would end up here. So this was tested with the African migratory locust, Locusta migratoria. We had four different diet pairings that varied in either the high carbohydrate or the high protein at the two different dilutions. So there would be the four spots in space if these guys just ate randomly over that final nymphal stadium. However, what happened was they all ended up here, regardless of the concentration or the pairing of the diet. So insects are able to regulate intake based on, we've seen now, on dilution, as well as variations in nutrient content. But again, we've seen that animals, insects can do this, well, at least locusts can do it, and we know now there's a lot of other insects will do it, ants, aphids, there's a whole range of insects where this has been shown that they will eat non-randomly to meet their nutrient requirements. But the big wide world out there is not always that nice. The host range for many insects can be restricted. You know, there's your mother leaves you on a leaf and you're that small you can't move, so what's there is what you've got. Predators may determine where you do and don't go to forage, but also microhabitat requirements. Insects are ectotherms, they can't function in cooler areas, they need heat, and that may affect what your diet breadth. So the question then is, well, once a meal has been ingested, what mechanisms do insects have, if any? Now what we found from some earlier work, or this same work, is you can see there's actually a range here where insects grew equally well and at the same rate. But what we also found was their body composition was very similar, despite the fact that they'd eaten quite different diets. High carbohydrate here and high protein here. So it suggests that they have some mechanisms to get rid of or rebalance their nutrient requirements. So get rid of what they don't need and rebalance to get that optimal PC ratio. Now, we've seen that foraging allows them to affect this in stage, but now what about, as I said, nutrition is a combination of not just what's ingested, but what's taken out, excreted, and this can be excreted or by not being absorbed, so not being digested, not being absorbed, or it can be absorbed and then losses removed via post-absorptive processing. We're going to firstly look at a morphological example, which is an evolutionary one, where an insect just altered its gut, and then we're going to look at some physiological mechanisms that insects employ to balance their nutritional needs after they've ingested food. Now, our first example is just by not absorbing it. And we see this as modification of the gut. And this is seen in a lot of phloem feeders, these aphids, psyllids, scale insects, where phloem, they pierce the phloem and they just suck it up. Now, phloem is extremely high in sugar, extremely high in water, and very low nitrogen. These guys have developed what's known as a filter chamber. They've modified their gut to allow the water and simple sugars to bypass the midgut. And you remember, the midgut's where all the absorption occurs. And we see this here. The insects, in this case, it pierces the plant. It takes the phloem up. Just trying to find its mouth. It's somewhere. Midgut. Is here, the esophagus. So the food comes in, and the anterior midgut is looped so that the start of the midgut here, this anterior part, is lined up with the hindgut. They're in contact. And it's able to remove just across, as you can see here, they're looped together. Because of a concentration gradient, the water and the sugar, most of the sugars, pass straight across into the hindgut. They never reach the midgut, so they're not absorbed and they're just directly excreted. And you've all seen the this is what we call honeydew on plants. You've seen the outcome of this. And by doing this, by removing excess sugar, but more importantly by removing all that water, they're able to concentrate the nutrients they need into the part of the midgut here where absorption occurs. And by this morphological change in morphology, they can rebalance their protein and carbohydrate requirements and get every last bit of sort of nitrogen out of that phloem. But another way insects could do it is just by not absorbing the material. So an insect can eat the food. Potentially, it could release enzymes in different ratios so that it could rebalance what it took up. It could also alter the things that it transported across the guts. But if it does take material up, its next step would be then to get rid of them via post-ingestive processes. It's just, if you absorb it, excrete it. And now, an example, we're going to look at a couple examples here, One is the preabsorptive. We have evidence that locusts can differentially release digestive enzymes and alter the amount of protein and carbohydrate taken up from plants. We know that we get, in response to different protein diets that vary in their protein and carbohydrate ratio, we get changes in the alimentary canal morphology. But whether this leads to a change in protein and carbohydrate taken up, or just that we tend to see bigger guts when insects eat diets where nutrients are very dilute, so it may actually help them process plant material at a faster rate. And we're currently got an experiment underway at the moment to see if, what the functional significance of bigger guts is. But there's also some evidence that for, well, other animals, that they can alter the transporters. And this, again, could vary the amount of protein or carbohydrate that's taken up. Post-absorptively, if it's gone across the gut, it's into the hemolymph, we know that insects can deaminate amino acids. We saw that transamination reaction earlier. And this removes the nitrogen compounds, and what you're left is with a carbon-based compound. The excess nitrogen can be excreted, and you've, in a sense, turned a nitrogen-based compound to a carbon-based compound, so it now can go into that carbohydrate pathway. But for the removal of excessive carbohydrate, or lipid if you're a carnivore, we know that insects can employ dietary-induced thermogenesis. And this is a facultative thermogenesis, and we know that they increase their metabolic rate just to pump off that extra carbohydrate. And think of it, for example, as just having your foot on the accelerator of the car. You burn energy, but you go nowhere. We also know that many inorganic ions, they're just, if they become, if you get too many of one, and they're just excreted. So here's our example of looking at the differential release of enzymes. We know this has been described for Locusta migratoria. We know it's been described in spiders, where digestion is extra oral, but we also know a lot of insects, especially carnivorous insects, also employ extra oral digestion. We don't know at this stage if they're able to regulate what they take up by differential release of enzymes. For our Locusta migratoria, we put them on these a diet high in protein and a diet high in carbohydrate, and this is their optimal requirements here. And they, so after 3 days, they'd ingested obviously a diet high in protein and low in carbohydrate, and the other one was low in protein and high in carbohydrate. And if they needed to rebalance their needs, they need to, on this diet, ingest a diet high in carbohydrate, and on this diet, obviously ingest a diet that's higher in protein. And what we found when we looked at chymotrypsin, and this is one of the enzymes that digests, breaks down proteins, is that on the diet where protein was being ingested in excess of carbohydrate, we saw this increase or difference between that where the insect needed to absorb more protein from its diet. And we saw the opposite for amylase. Amylase is the enzyme that's released to break down starch and polysaccharides. So when carbohydrate was ingested in excess of protein, less amylase was found in the tissues. But we then looked at, well, did this actually result in differential uptake of nutrients? And what we found was, this was our the average protein to carbohydrate ratio of the grasses, which was very similar to our two diets. So insects that were ingesting protein in far greater amounts than they needed ingested more carbohydrate out of this grass, and this was for, so you got the same results regardless of grass species used, than those where they needed more protein. So they'd been conditioned on this high carb diet. And we found this is about a 25% difference. So insects were able to modify the protein carbohydrate of what they ingested just by this differential release of digestive enzymes. And in this case, it was just chymotrypsin and amylase. And I've already mentioned this, but if, again, insects do take in meals that they're unable to, and they've absorbed it, and the ratio of protein to carbohydrate's not what they need, they can deaminate the nitrogen and excrete it, and then use the carbohydrate backbone for energy. And we know from studies on longevity with Drosophila, if you put almost any insect that we've looked at so far, if you give them a diet high in nitrogen, they live much shorter time than if you restrict nitrogen in their diet. But what was interesting was found by this recently by a group in America was that if you then gave the insects that were on a high protein diet access to free water, they found no difference in longevity between the insects on the high nitrogen and the insects on a lower nitrogen diet. And their interpretation of this was, and it would seem that nitrogen, if you deaminate protein, you get this build-up of nitrogen. Nitrogen's quite toxic, as you'll be aware from the excretion lecture, but if you've got water and you can flush it out, you can remove those deleterious effects of eating an imbalanced diet. And we've also talked about if you eat increased carbohydrate or lipid, just that increase in metabolic rate that can help rebalance. Unfortunately for me, who love my donuts, it doesn't rebalance enough. Now, final way in which insects can get the nutrients they require is by the use of symbionts. These can be extra or intracellular microorganisms, such as bacteria, yeast, protists, fungi. They contribute to the nutrition of the insect via nitrogen, amino acid synthesis, vitamin, sterile, and in some cases a carbohydrate economy. We tend to find symbionts more in herbivores than carnivores because non-energy plants contain less nitrogen than animals, but they also have different sterile and amino acid profiles. And insects can use symbionts to get those that they require. An extreme example is the termites. Termites live in wood where nitrogen is exceptionally low compared to carbohydrate. And most of that carbohydrate is in the form of cellulose, which is indigestible to the termite itself. So it employs symbionts to break that down. But additionally, they also house nitrogen-fixing bacteria in the hindgut. And this can fix atmospheric N. So the termites provide the bacteria with energy, or the wood, and the bacteria can then break that down and provide the termite with nitrogen, but also some energy as well, but also a lot of vitamins also. Now, we've looked at a range of mechanisms. We've looked at how insects can ingest food, but we've also looked at how they can use post-ingestive balancing. But we still know that insects, when they're in real life, the real world, so to speak, they do suffer constraints on their growth and development. So post-ingestive balancing and what's out there in your diet, what's available to you, can only do so much. So the next question is, well, what happens when an insect or is forced to eat a suboptimal diet? And for many insects, this is the case. This is your requirements, and this is what you're stuck with. So if this is the requirements for protein and carbohydrate that an insect have, if it's forced to eat a diet where carbohydrate is in excess of requirements relative to protein, it's offered it could eat varying amounts of this food. For example, it could eat so that In this case, his carbohydrate requirements are met, but it will suffer a deficit in protein. Or it could eat so that the nutrient that was limiting requirements were met and suffer, and in this case, ingest excessive carbohydrate. And we know from that landscape that either under-ingesting or if you're on a suboptimal diet, if it's higher in protein or carbohydrate to requirements, you're going to suffer losses. There are costs to this. So there's costs to under-ingestion and there's costs to over-ingestion. So we also know that, well, potentially an insect could eat anywhere between these two points. It could eat so that the deficit and the excess are equal, or potentially anywhere else along that line. And what we see is we can roughly break this into what we call three main rules, depending on how much on the animal places on the excess or a deficit of a nutrient. And we see that you could have an excess where it's greater than the deficit, the situation where the excess and the deficit are equal, so this here, or a scenario where the excess is less than the deficit. So eating somewhere in here. And when we look at insects, we'll take two examples here. One is Locusta migratoria. This animal eats on grass. And our second example is Schistocerca gregaria, or the desert locust. And this is an animal that eats more of a mixed diet. It eats grasses and forbs. Now, both these animals have the same intake target. If we give them that experiment where they get to choose between protein and carbohydrate, they eat exactly the same amount. However, when they're forced onto suboptimal diets, they do two different things. They compromise between the amount of protein and carbohydrate they either over or under ingest. And what we see in the case of our specialist feeder, the deficit is always greater than the excess. You can see here. They do not want to over-ingest the nutrient that's in excess in their diet. However, our Schistocerca eats such that the excess and the deficit are equal. And we see this both, we also see this in caterpillars, and Drosophila, I think, also do the same thing depending on their dietary history. Now, one of the reasons for this could be is that if you're a generalist, this is what we call a generalist feeder, and this doesn't necessarily relate to their breadth of food source. It relates to how they respond to suboptimal diets. But these guys eat a variety of foods. Now, one of the things they could be doing is, because they're able to ingest a whole range of foods, is that they're more prepared to over-ingest these suboptimal diets because they have a higher probability of finding a diet over here that would balance their intake. So they'll over-ingest that nutrient because they can pay it back later by eating this one. Whereas our grass-feeding specialist, if it's only eating grasses tend to have less variation across them, or maybe have less variation across them. Therefore, their probability of encountering, if they're eating a meal down here, of encountering the anecdote, the opposite one, to rebalance their needs here pre-ingestively, is very low. So they're not prepared to over-ingest a nutrient in excess. And we know this occurs between species. We also know this occurs within Schistocerca, changes from this generalist feeder to a specialist feeder when it changes from being gregarious, that's when they are in large numbers and swarm, to when it's solitary. It's when it's solitary, it's a grass feeder and it behaves the same way as Locusta migratoria. We've currently got work underway in the lab at the moment to see if we can change this within. Can we teach our insect and train it within its environment to change from this to this? And we have some evidence that we can do that. After a generation of diets where we train them that their environment contained nutrients sort of from this ratio to this ratio, we have some evidence now that they're more prepared to overeat these extreme diets. And this is work that we're really currently exploring, as it has major implications to the foraging behaviour of a lot of insects. So, we've talked a lot about regulation of nutrient intake, and this is where we're sort of going to pull together from the last three lecture. What does an insect need to be able to regulate its intake? It needs to know what the nutrient composition of the food is. And we saw in the first lecture, that one on feeding, where they can do it directly by tasting. They have all those scintilla on the mouth parts. They can taste it. They can take an exploratory bite, which would release chemicals, and get feedback that way. But insects can also do it via learning. And many plants have specific waxes on them, so the animal can learn from those waxes what's inside it. And in the lab, this has been demonstrated that insects will learn based on colour of food. You can put a protein always above a green label, and carbohydrate, for example, yellow. And the insect will learn that protein's green and carbohydrate's yellow. You can feed them on a high carb diet and then give them a choice between a green door and a yellow door, and they'll go to the green door. It's also been done with scent, the same response. You can train them that protein is spearmint, for example, and if they need protein, they'll go to the spearmint. Odour. But secondly, one thing is knowing what the nutrient composition of the food is, but the insect, to be able to regulate its intake, has to know what its state is, or its nutritional status. And it can do this, obviously, via its hemolymph composition, but also the status of nutrient reserves, which is mostly fat, but also nitrogen. But to regulate it, intake, an insect has to be able to compare food and its state. We saw in that first lecture how the sensitivity of the scintilla, how many spikes or how active they were, how they responded to different foods, was a function of the state of the insect. So an insect that had been eating a lot of protein responded to carbohydrate when it was touched to its scintilla, but not protein. And this is the peripheral taste receptors. And these taste receptors are regulated by metabolic and physiological feedbacks from the central nervous system. It then provides that excitation whereby an animal will eat a meal, and depending on the rate of excitation as to how much it will eat of that. So insects don't have to count calories. They've got this wonderful mechanism whereby if a nutrient's in deficit in their diet, their peripheral taste receptors will respond very strongly to it. They'll eat a lot of it and rebalance that way. We also know now from our work on the alimentary canal that there's a hell of a lot of receptors in there, and these would also seem to be determining what's coming down the gut, and then telling the mid-gut cells where all the enzymes are made to either release them or not release them. Because although we found differences in the contents of the midgut in the amounts of the different enzymes, we found no differences in the cells, the midgut cells. So it also seemed to be there's another sort of feedback mechanism there. These receptors sit in the gut itself. They also sit in the hemolymph. So again, there's another balancing that they can do. Also, learning is a way that they can regulate their intake. So just in summary, and I'm sorry I've used a locus, but you're probably a bit sick of them by now, but locus and caterpillars is what we know most of our information and for all these things is. So to balance its diet or get its nutritional requirements, an insect can choose what it's going to eat, and this is going to be affected by, well, its evolutionary history. Is it a plant feeder or an animal feeder? It's going to depend on its age of the animal. Is it reproductive or is it still a juvenile growing? It's also going to depend on, well, what was its last meal? It's then going to, well, the next thing an insect is going to depend on, you know, diet choice. Well, what's out there in the environment? What sort of deterrents or toxins do plants put in them versus sort of the range of phagostimulants? And it's going to be, nutrition is going to be affected by things that really have no direct effect on it, such as predators, microhabitat. Then, once it's decided what to eat, an animal can decide how much to eat of it, how often to eat it. But also, we know that nutrition will be affected by, well, how easily can it get that meal from the, get the nutrients out of the food. The food's big, it's got to break it down to smaller parts. How well it does that is going to affect not only the rate of digestion, but also we know from plant material how much of the protein relative to carbohydrate they get out. We know with mammals that mandible sharpness plays a big, well, tooth sharpness plays a big role in this. We have no idea for insects. Digestion. We've seen how the differential release of nutrients can affect uptake, but also food retention time. If the food's retained in the gut for longer, potentially more, you'll get a higher rate of digestion. What's assimilated and allocated to growth is going to be a function of, well, its costs in terms of its metabolic requirements, how much it costs to get that diet and process it, and its behaviour. An animal that's flying has much higher carbohydrate requirements or energy requirements than one that's just walking around. But also we know that nutrition, after a meal's been assimilated, they can use some post-absorptive processes to rebalance. So some nitrogen compounds, for example, that are have been ingested in excess to requirements can be excreted, while carbohydrate or lipid that's ingested in excess to requirements can be got rid of just by an increase by a metabolic rate. So, at the end of this lecture, you should have, well, some idea of what insects need and how they go about balancing demand and supply. And this is a huge field, and this is one very small lecture. And I suggest that you read Chapter 4 of Chapman. Chapter 9 of Chapman and De Boer is excellent. That was Steve Simpson's chapter. Also, Chan and Nicholson, Chapter 2, again, has a very good summary. And if you're interested in this topic, I've suggested some references that you should look at. Spence Beamer, who's written a review last year on insect herbivore nutrition and regulation. David Robenheimer and Steve Simpson in 2004 wrote a very easy to understand introduction to Unraveling the Tangle of Nutritional Complexity. A far more sophisticated and detailed summary was written last year for the Functional Ecology Special Edition on Nutrition. One of the most brilliant papers I think I read was this Steve Simpson, David Ruhmer's paper on feeding behaviour, sensory physiology and nutritional feedback, and just looking at how insects regulate intake. Again, this has all been summarised, this early work in The Hungry Locust. And finally, I'd suggest you reading Optimal Foraging When Regulating Intake of Multiple Nutrients. And this lays out the groundwork for these concepts that I've described here. Thank you.